Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Oral histories fill in the gaps of the empty pages of history, particularly in communities of color. Oral historian Elena Faulis is an associate professor and director of Spanish language studies at Texas A&M University, San Antonio. She has spent years collecting oral histories and preparing the next generation of oral historians inside and outside the classroom. Faulis has written a guide on how to gather oral histories in Latino communities with an emphasis on equitable and culturally sustaining practices. It's called Embodied Encuentros, Oral History Archives of Latina, Latino, Latine Experiences. It details the work she's done and what she has learned in the years she spent connecting with communities in her previous longtime home of Ohio and more recently in South Texas. She says her interest in oral history began with a course she was teaching at The Ohio State University.
I was teaching a service learning course in Spanish, and the students got to work with the Latino communities in Columbus, Ohio. And I felt that the materials that I had to prepare them for that, you know, for understanding Latino communities in the Midwest, wasn't enough to really prepare them to work locally. You know, there wasn't any other resource about, you know, Latinos in Ohio, Latinos in the Midwest. So I thought, well, I've always been interested in listening to other people's stories. You know, I'm an immigrant myself and moved to Ohio in the early 1990s. And I thought, well, I also want to know, like, about the experiences of other people like me that came as immigrants or just migrants from other states. So I began collecting initially so that I could provide a resource for my class. But that quickly became a larger scale project. I invited a lot of my students to work with me and travel the state to collect oral histories. And we went everywhere. We went to Southern Ohio. We went to the major cities as well, Cincinnati, Cleveland. And that experience, right, like that on the road experience with the students was also a teaching moment, right, for them to be witnessing, collecting the stories of their own communities. Some of my students in that class were Latino, some were not. So different perspectives, right, or the way that they were understanding the stories of our communities were different, but deeply engaged in the process and in the storytelling. I enjoyed recording every single story because I always learn, right? Even though the questions are all the same, and in some sense you expect some commonalities, right? Being in front of a person face to face and listening, and for many of them, the majority of them, getting to tell their experience and their story for the first time is a big deal. And their own voices, right? And their own memories. I usually had 2 to 3 students with me that came. I wanted them to be part of the process, to collect with me. I mean, they help with taking pictures, with, you know, making sure all the forms were signed. But then also that experience afterwards and just talking about it and noticing things right afterwards that perhaps me being very focused, listening to the speaker, to the narrator, I wasn't aware of everything else that was going on. So that's how it started. And now we have over 160 stories in that particular archive.
And now you are here in South Texas, and you've brought that oral history tradition with you. And I know it's made some change, some evolution since you started in Ohio, but still very much involving students in the process. Mm. Have you seen very similar reactions from students in Ohio and here in Texas, that whether they are Latino or not, whether they feel sort of more emotionally and culturally connected to themselves? Because I know you actually encourage the students to share their own experiences right. as well as those of the people they're interviewing.
Right. So I do teach a course on Latinx digital humanities. In the past 2 years, we've been focusing on digital archives focused on oral histories. So they get to sort of explore, you know, archives across the country of Latino individuals, narrators, and their experiences in different parts of the country, which is super unique and exciting for my students to hear. A lot of our students, at least the students that I have currently in my courses, they are local. They're from Texas. They don't travel very far away from Texas for different reasons. I remember one of the students saying, wow, like I didn't know that I had so much in common with this, you know, particular narrator in a completely different part of the country. But also listening to people that were very different than them, right? Growing up very differently than them. So, and also finding kinship in the stories that they hear, right? And what does that mean for us here in Texas as we listen to the stories of our communities, right? And so it's opened up really fruitful and engaging conversations about belonging, about who we are in relation to them, right? And then exploring the richness of our community here, right? And so one of the students, which is, I think, one of the stories that I start with in the book, is that she wanted to record first, which is very important, and hopefully it's a future project, to document the businesses who are facing gentrification in our city here in San Antonio, on the west side in particular. So she wanted to document that, but it was also just a semester, and she felt that that project, and I agreed with her, would take longer, right, to develop those relationships and to start engaging with potential narrators. So then she shifted to recording, which I thought it was very fun.
Big shift.
Yes, big shift, right, to recording skaters in San Antonio, right? Because she is a skater herself. And I thought, well, this is your community, right? And this is, you already have an inside, begin having those conversations. And then I asked her, why is this important? And one of the things that I remember just talking to her about was this idea of joy, right? Like Latino joy. Can we show that Latino communities, despite everything, you know, that might be happening around our city, you know, gentrification, politics, et cetera, ICE lately, there are moments of joy through practices and also outdoor. You know, she said, I want to specifically think about Latino joy in the outdoors. Like we are expressing this in la calle, no? En la calle. And I thought that was really significant, right? To document that. But I think for the most part, I want students to think about the knowledge that our community has and the value that it brings to our classroom's discussions, because many times they haven't really thought about how much history, how much knowledge our community has that is worth studying and exploring and documenting and sharing.
There's a whole process involved in trying to make sure that you collect these stories in a very culturally engaging yet mm-hmm. respectful manner. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, how do you find the people you're going to interview? And then how do you decide that you're going to share it? You're talking right now about digital humanity. So mm-hmm. online is one way right. to be able to share that. So sort of walk us through the process of how that idea starts and when it actually blooms into this final project.
Right. And I can tell you that some of the students' work and projects have not been public because we do talk about ethical practices, right? What stories do we need to care for? What stories are worth sharing publicly, and what stories do we share in the classroom? And what I'm saying is that at any moment, unfortunately, our community can face vulnerabilities that we were not planning for originally, right? I can tell you that one of the projects was related to DACA and undocumented students in higher education. And although we follow all of the steps, right, all the informed consent to make sure that we are being responsible with the information and with the stories that they trust us to collect, we often make decisions with the narrator, right, and conversation and dialogue with the narrator about whether the stories can and should be public, or if at any moment they might want to remove them, right, from the websites or from, you know, any digital platforms because of the vulnerabilities. I had a student that focused on one individual only about their life as a trans person, right? And so much has changed in the last 2 years alone that those stories are now very vulnerable, right? Are in vulnerable situations. So we have to make sort of those decisions. Is this putting somebody at risk? What kind of things are we sharing publicly, and what kind of things? I mean, names don't always have to be real or even public. Dates, you know, we talk about birthdays or locations. That's not the focus of the story, right? And so just to make sure that those vulnerabilities are not amplified for our communities.
Elena Faulis is an associate professor and director of Spanish language studies at Texas A&M University, San Antonio. She's the author of Embodied Encuentros, Oral History Archives of Latina, Latino, Latine Experiences. When we come back, a performance of oral histories moved one audience member to reflect on her past.
I'm one of the only Latinas in this particular high school where she was going. And, you know, I am struggling with, like, keeping my identity or, like, keeping my Spanish as part of who I am.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Trusted journalism matters more than ever. Including TPR in your will helps ensure thoughtful, fact-based news remains strong in Texas for years to come. Learn more at tpr.org/legacy.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Gathering oral histories goes beyond just coming up with an idea, picking up a recorder or video camera, and booking an interview. The process is heavy on relationship building. Get to know the community you're profiling, earn their trust, immerse yourself in their stories, and be culturally humble. Oral historian Elena Faulis has written about these practices in her new book, Embodied Encuentros, Oral History Archives of Latina, Latino, Latine Experiences. She says her students are taught to prioritize listening throughout the entire process.
If we're working with a specific community, I'm the one that sort of starts engaging with the community and, you know, establishing those relationships, talking about the project. But sometimes our students already have those relationships with the community. And so for me, it's important that we first establish that, right? So understand where we're going, who our community is, who our narrators are, and why they would want to share, you know, their stories with us. I think building that trust is super, super important. And that's why I encourage the individual projects, if they already have access to a community, either they are a part of or they're in close relationship with. Otherwise, they get to work with me, you know, who has already established those relationships, and that could bring students along. Usually, most of the time, our narrators are really invested in our students. They actually love to see young people, you know. And for a long time, I didn't allow students to do the recordings because I was afraid, you know, like forgetting to hit record, you know, and all of that.
Guilty.
Stuff. Oh, absolutely. And a lot of times, right, our narrators are super excited to see the students there. But there was one year that my students, particularly one student that had been working with me in different projects, so she had recorded a podcast, she had done digital storytelling, she had done several things, so she was very comfortable interviewing and using the media, the recording materials and everything. And she said, "Profe, I want to record stories. I want to go into the communities and do this myself." I'm like, okay. It ended up being three students that I trained specifically. Okay, let's go through the questions. What does it mean to listen attentively and to do follow-up questions? And, you know, you can write notes, but like very few notes, you know. So we went through the whole thing and we still went together because I never advise for whoever's doing the interview to go alone. And it was another level of that learning experience for the student to actually be listening to their elders. A lot of times they were, you know, elders from the community. And for the elders to be so invested is this added responsibility of like, oh, we're passing down our stories, you know, to the younger generation, to the students. So it was super sweet to see, you know, that interaction between young people and the elders and just that added commitment, right, from both parties, from the students to get the story, but then also from the elders to make sure that they were contributing that knowledge. So it's been amazing to see them also blossom, right, into this interviewers. And yeah, I think not everybody likes, I guess, using students for oral history. I think if you train them and you trust the students and you work with students close enough, that they can do this stuff. They know, they understand, right? And I think you get a different kind of story if a younger person is recording it.
And you have to start somewhere, right? Exactly. You're not just born an oral historian. You have to get your foot in the door somehow.
Absolutely.
And that's a perfect way to do it. So I want to talk a little bit about the title of the book, Embodied Encuentros. This is actually sort of a method that you write about mm-hmm. in this book regarding oral history collection. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that means?
Right. So Embodied Encuentros is the idea that we are fully present with the community and we fully understand the community. So we are there engaging in non-extractive ways and culturally sustaining ways so we understand the community who we're working with. We don't have to be experts, you know, but we understand their cultural and linguistic practices. We understand the local history or have an understanding of the local history. And it's building that relationship and thinking of this project, of this encuentro as long lasting, not just that particular moment when we hit record and stop, but really it starts before and after the interview is collected. So it really emphasizes this ethical approach of engaging with Latino communities in culturally and linguistically sustaining ways.
And we, you know, we've talked to you in the past about language and, mm-hmm. and the importance of language. And a really interesting technique that I think that you use that might maybe confuse maybe solely Spanish speakers or solely English yeah. speakers mm-hmm. is that you choose not to translate much of what the individual speaks, especially if they're speaking in Spanish or in Spanglish,
right.
as it is. So explain to us why that is.
Yes, you know, people go back and forth, right? And even me, I think if it's important enough and I want this audience to fully understand, a monolingual audience to understand what the narrator said, then I would translate. But I think you miss a little bit of the essence of the story if you translate from English to Spanish or vice versa, or even Spanglish, right? So for me, it's important. It's also an emphasis on what that person is most comfortable speaking and understanding that as part of their identity, right? So I don't have to translate that identity for them. That's who they are. And that's how they feel most comfortable, right? Expressing their ideas, their stories. To me, that's fundamental of the story, you know, to be able to collect in the language that they feel most comfortable with. So not translating is this message that is also sent, right, that, hey, we're entering into a new community. We are listening or reading somebody else's perspective in their own language, right? I also do the same about translanguaging or Spanglish, using Spanglish. I don't translate or correct, you know, I'm doing comillas, no, entre comillas, quote unquote, any of their language practices, because that is a sign of who they are and where they grew up and where they live now, right? And so to me, that's very, very important and respectful, you know, of doing that work of remaining true to the story and the language that they speak it. I can always provide a summary. I can always provide, you know, a translation if needed. But I think it's an important way to represent the community and how they choose to be represented, too.
We were talking a little bit about preserving some of these stories on a digital archive. I think the Voces Oral History Project is one that maybe many people have already sort of famously heard of. They've done so many different projects, and you have also done a lot of digital archiving of oral histories. But there is also something that you wrote about in this book that I thought was really fascinating, is an actual performance of these oral histories. So talk to us a little bit about that decision and why you think that is just, you know, one more way of being able to share these stories. Because they're not just telling these stories just to tell it to one person. They're telling these stories so that more and other people can hear and learn.
That was so fun to be able to do performances with students. And I did that four times, I think. And during COVID, you know, we had to be creative even more about how to do this work. So one of the reasons why I think oral history it has an intended audience, I guess. If you do it in an archive and people visit the archive, and they're not going to listen to every story. I mean, 160 stories, right? They're going to pick and choose something that they're interested in, or maybe there is a person that they want to focus on, and that's great and wonderful, right? But I think that through performance, we opened up the archive to a wider audience. So the first time we actually did this, we chose a theme with the students. My students have been all in, right? They're like, yes, we want this. And I started this in Ohio, and I haven't been able to do it here in Texas, but that's one of my goals. I think at that moment and with the students, it was a way for them to build community through this work. And so we focused on language, the experiences of languages, right? We know we have a history, right, of in Texas and elsewhere of Spanish being removed from the schools or being physically punished for speaking Spanish in public. And we collected stories of a lot of narrators in Ohio in particular that were talking about their language experiences. So what we did is that we went through the transcripts. We selected specifically quotes from the narrators where they spoke about language experiences. And then we were sort of talking back or having a dialogue with the narrators, ourselves as performers, responding to that experience. Like, what was our experience like, right? Of, you know, for me, learning English, for others, learning Spanish, for others, you know, teaching their children to speak, you know, Spanish. We had sort of the ideal audience when we performed for the first time. It was in Bowling Green. They have a Latinx conference every year, and the audience was primarily bilingual. And we performed, and it was primarily reading and choral, right, spoken. And we engaged with the audience. We asked questions about language experiences. And at the end, we asked about what was it like, you know, to listen to it. Some of our audience members were monolingual. So what was it like when you heard Spanish and weren't able to get every single, you know, thing of the performance? And what was super surprising was that in the audience, someone as young as a high school student at that time said, I'm going through this right now. People see me. I'm one of the only Latinas in this particular high school where she was going. And, you know, I am struggling with like keeping my identity or like keeping my Spanish as part of who I am. Very emotional, very emotional. And then we had audience members that were older and then just kind of sharing, you know, that experience. And so through oral history, we were able to connect, you know, with this audience and talk about things that not only happened 50 years ago, they're happening now. And as you know, we have a new executive order that has made English the official language. And I'm usually the person that's, you know, sees the glass half empty, but I do feel like we're going to have a generation that's going to be hesitant about keeping their Spanish or any other language, right? That's not English as part of who they are. But yeah, so we were able to do performances during COVID because we recorded outdoors, we recorded indoors, either with a mask or, you know, whatever they felt most comfortable with. And so out of that collection of oral histories, we put together a performance that we ended up recording. We didn't have a live audience as it would have been the ideal way to present it. We have a video about it, and we actually presented over Zoom. We also found that it was important for us to bring in those stories because we also saw a disparity, right? Who had access to information and could navigate COVID easier than other communities, right? And so we saw this huge disparity of professionals, you know, Latino professionals who they got to stay at home and work, had all the information that they needed from their employers. And then you had Latinos in service jobs, you know, either at hospitals or food industries who could not, right? And who were most affected, right? And how they navigated sort of that situation. So we thought it was important to also do that.
Well, you talked a little bit about English as an official language and how you might be wanting to pursue that. And as we know, oral history tends to kind of fill in the gaps of, mm-hmm. you know, what may be missing in telling our stories, the stories of people of color in particular. Mm-hmm. Is there any one topic or maybe a list of themes that you think you might want to explore in the future in regards to oral history?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I want to focus on that stories about language in conversations about the new executive order, but also just as an identity, right? An identity marker. I'm actually doing a project with one of my students currently. We're talking about the No Sabo kids. Mm-hmm. That particular label, I guess, is being changed, right, and reappropriated.
Well, for people who don't know what a No Sabo kid is, can you explain?
Yes. The No Sabo kids are usually Spanish speakers that grew up in the U.S. who have gained language experiences in Spanish, primarily orally, and sometimes make non-standard grammatical choices when they speak. And so often, unfortunately, they're criticized for not knowing the language or not keeping up with the Spanish, when in reality, some of them have not gone to a school, right, that is either dual language or all in Spanish. So they grow up with a stigma, right, of not knowing Spanish well or not keeping up with their traditions or identity.
Which is called No Sabo because instead of no sé, I don't know, they say No Sabo.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that label, right, for younger generations now is being taken as a term of empowerment because they're reclaiming their use of Spanish, the Spanish in the U.S., you know, variation, and refusing, you know, sort of standard language ideologies, right? And so my students sort of conducted oral histories, right, of older generations and their experiences specifically with language in public and in the schools. And so I think this is an exciting new direction, right, of thinking about oral history with that specific topic and gaining so much understanding from it, from first-person narratives. I mean, we can do research, we can do, you know, have a quantitative, you know, how many people do, how many people don't. But that first-person narrative is very powerful. And one of the things, just from conversations that I have with my student as we're, you know, we're working together on this project, is the unexpected emotional reaction of the narrators when they talk about language experiences, right? And so we prepare for that. When I train him to interview, I said, you know, we might not think of it, but language, when we talk about language, sometimes is an experience of trauma because either the language was taken away from people or they just had negative experiences related to speaking Spanish or learning English or whatever the case might be. So we need to be prepared and allow that moment to happen in the interview and then think of ways to just move forward with that.
So anything that I didn't get a chance to ask you about that you'd like to talk about before we wrap things up?
Yes. So one of the last chapters in the book talks about the Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. And it's a project that didn't happen in a way. When I moved to San Antonio, it had been 4 months since that school shooting had happened. And we had an opportunity as a university to work in some way to acknowledge and honor the lives that were lost during the shooting. And so I was teaching the digital humanities class, and I offered that as an option for my students. I say, let's see what we can do. What can we document, right? Then I said, I don't, you know, this is voluntary. You don't have to work on this. This is very, it's hard. It's hard work. It's, you know, we're dealing with traumas. And so I had 6 students sign up right away. There was one that had a very deep connection to Uvalde. But we also decided that interviewing the families was not going to be what we wanted to do. We knew that the community was being bombarded by the media. There was just so many things going on, and we didn't want to be requesting interviews or anything like that. So we shifted and focused on the murals that they painted over in Uvalde. So a student and I went, took pictures, and then we created sort of a small archive of the pictures and interviewed one of the muralists and then one of the people that sort of organized the murals to be painted. And so what I wanted to say, or what I'm saying in that chapter, that sometimes we can do oral history without inflicting further trauma or being respectful to those communities that are still, like, it's so, the wound is not healed. I mean, we're 4 years of, you know, from that, and I don't think that wound is healed or it will ever be healed. And so sometimes those projects need to take the back seat, right, until it is relevant or it is appropriate, or maybe we can do something adjacent to it, right? And so for us, we wanted to document the moment to honor those lives, so be respectful, and then to have those conversations in the class about what else can we do to make sure that this is a fruitful conversation that we have in the community and that we honor the lives of the people that died. So we shifted, I guess, in that way. So sometimes we are, as oral historians, are quick to, oh, okay, we need to document that, right? We need to document the victims of this. And sometimes we don't have to. We can wait. We can wait. We can let people just rest and be, and then later perhaps revisit that conversation.
Has maybe anybody thought of giving them the tools to record their own oral histories on their own?
Yes. there is, through, I believe, through Baylor's Oral History Center, They wrote a grant, and I believe it was an NEH grant, to provide resources and training to one of the libraries in Uvalde, Texas, to start recording the oral histories. I don't think that work has started. They're just in the planning, which is great. Like, it doesn't need to be rushed, right? And it's a very responsible and ethical way to do it, right? We train or give the tools that the community needs, and then they can plan it out as they see fit for their own community.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elena Faulis, great conversation. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Elena Faulis is an associate professor and director of Spanish language studies at Texas A&M University, San Antonio. She's the author of Embodied Encuentros, Oral History Archives of Latina, Latino, Latine Experiences. Faulis was recently elected to the board of directors of the Texas Oral History Association based out of Baylor University. Go to TPR.org to see the COVID-era video of Elena Faulis's Ohio State students performing the oral narratives of Latinos in Ohio. And Elena Faulis will be reading from Embodied Encuentros at San Antonio's Guadalupe Latino Bookstore Saturday, May 2nd at 2 p.m. It's free to attend. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. Sharanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.